test pilots hadn't taken risks, we wouldn't have had the 747. You know, two of the Comets blew up in the early days of airline travel, and now airline travel is as safe as anything. We've got to go through the difficult testing stage of creating a space line in order to make it safe for travelers who want to travel on that space line in the years ahead. And, you know, we will persevere and we will succeed.
Richard Branson, founder of Virgin Galactic, speaking with CNN today. The company's Spaceship Two crashed during a test flight on Friday. The idea behind Virgin Galactic is to send regular non-astronauts on a flight into space where they can experience weightlessness. More than 700 people have reserved a seat on a Virgin Galactic flight, including celebrities such as Leonardo DiCaprio, Angelina Jolie, Katy Perry. If you're thinking about joining them, you should know that tickets are currently $250,000. Branson had said he and his children would be on the first commercial flight before the end of this year, and more recently he said flights would start next spring, but that might be pushed back now. Jonathan McDowell is an astronomer at the Harvard Smithsonian Center for Astrophysics, and he also blogs at Jonathan's Space Report, and he's here now with the latest. Hi.
Hi there.
Okay, what do we know now from the NTSB about why Spaceship Two crashed on Friday?
Well, first, I have to say that the investigation is still in its early stages, but they made a very important statement yesterday, which is that they discovered that the tail booms on the spacecraft were deployed prematurely. And so what happens is this vehicle has long tails sticking out behind it that rotate, unlike on an ordinary aircraft, and that's done when the vehicle is coming back down to land to give it stability in the atmosphere, and it sort of floats on the thin air of the upper atmosphere. You're not meant to do it while you're on the way up under rocket power. And so what happened was a lever was moved in the cockpit that unlocked the booms. There's another button that deploys them, which wasn't pressed. But the buffeting, as the thing was going through Mach 1, must have triggered it and let it move. So we don't know why this happened, whether there was some emergency that the pilot was trying to respond to or whether it was just a mistake. We'll have to wait for more investigation. So it's an aerodynamic failure. The thing just came apart in the air when it went into the wrong configuration.
So we don't know yet if it was a malfunction on the part of the equipment itself, or if it was operator error. We don't know that yet.
Right. We don't know, and it's certainly a combination of both, possibly. Mm-hmm. But we'll have to wait and see whether there was pilot error or whether there's some other explanation. What does seem to be the case is that the rocket engine, which people were super worried about, seems to have worked okay. And so, you know, that at least is good news for Virgin Galactic.
Okay, so Virgin Galactic is not the only company that is trying to get into this market of commercial space exploration. And some critics have said that Spaceship Two is flawed. Its test flights are not safe because it's rushing to be the first.
Yeah, I think there's a real concern there. You know, Branson made some really good statements that you played just now about how you have to do testing to make sure things are safe. But at the same time, the number of test flights that he'd been talking about recently in order to start flying himself and flying passengers was really small compared to the number of test flights that a commercial airliner does. So I'm concerned that the pressure of investors, the pressure of competition from other companies like X-Corp, it has been making them rush too fast. But if they slow down, if they take the time to test it properly, then there's no reason that it shouldn't be safe.
Well, tell us about Spaceship Two. How many passengers could it take on a flight, and what would they experience?
Right. So I believe it would take 6 passengers together with the 2 pilots. And what happens is you sit in this cabin, and the carrier plane takes off, and you're being held underneath the carrier plane. You go up to about 15,000 meters, which is higher than significantly higher than a normal airliner would fly. And then the carrier plane drops you, You're falling through the air. A second later, the rocket motor ignites. You're pushed back in your seat, a bit like when an airplane takes off, but much more sporty. And and you very quickly, a few seconds later, are going through the speed of sound. You're flying supersonic. After about a minute of that, the engine switches off, and suddenly you're floating. And you, having been pushed back in your seat, you're now as forward as you can be with your seatbelt. You undo your seatbelt, and you start floating around, and you get a few minutes only of floating around in space, looking out the window, seeing the curvature of the Earth beneath you, the blackness of space. It's time to sit back down as you re-enter the atmosphere and glide back down to a landing in the airport you started off at.
How long does that take, all of that?
It's end-to-end, it's about 15 minutes. So that's not a lot of time for $250,000.
Yeah, that's incredible. It sounds like a wild ride, a big, big roller coaster.
Yeah, biggest fairground in the world. And you know, if you have more like $20 or $30 million, you can get. Yeah, you used to be able to get a week on the space station. They're not doing that so much anymore. But that gives you a sense of how much more expensive it's going to be to get into orbit, to have a more thorough space experience. So for now, even for very rich people, the 15-minute suborbital joyride is probably as good as they're gonna get.
All right, Jonathan, thank you very much for joining us.
You're welcome.
Jonathan McDowell, astronomer at the Harvard Smithsonian Center for Astrophysics. He blogs at Jonathan's Space Report. All right, let's turn now to Adam Rogers. He's Wired Magazine editor, and he's written a piece that explores the question, is space tourism worth dying for? He joins us now. Welcome.
Thank you very much.
Okay, so what do you make of this gigantic roller coaster ride?
Well, it does sound like a hell of a ride. I think the question that I would ask, the question I tried to ask in the piece that I wrote on Friday was whether that's actually going to space and whether that is living up to the sort of rhetoric that that Richard Branson and that other folks have tried to wrap around what Virgin Galactic is going to attempt to do.
Right. Now, he has said that, look, it was risky when commercial air travel first debuted, and this is just tragic, simply tragic, but it is the price you have to pay for advancing science.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's no question that human beings take on a certain amount of risk with every kind of big engineering endeavor that we do, and it's our job to assess whether they're worth whether those risks are worth taking. I think, and I would say that in this case, I don't mean to be presumptuous about what risk the pilot and co-pilot assumed for themselves. What I mean to ask is whether this is whether these are the kind of deaths and injuries that are. What we are being told is that they're in order to further human achievement, to further our evolution into the stars. And what I'm suggesting is that this is a company that has a very complicated engineering project that looks like it would be really interesting to work on and probably really fulfilling if you were a pilot who loved that stuff. But trying to connect it to human evolution and exploration and pioneering up into the stars, I think is a stretch. I think even beyond that, I think a misdirect.
Well, what's the difference then between this kind of private space exploration, private rides up into space, and government-sponsored ones by NASA?
Well, this is what I want to try to be really clear about this, and it's possible that I haven't been. I think that this is not private space exploration. I think that this is an exciting ride that brushes up against the bottom of space. Mm-hmm. So I don't really care who's funding it. I would like the government to be funding a space program. I think that human beings do have to be thinking about how to get off the planet for a lot of reasons, because disaster comes, whether it's something that we cause or whether it's something that comes from nature. Asteroids, as I say in the piece, asteroids have wiped this planet clean before, and they will again. We have reasons to want to go out into the stars that are not just exploration and pioneering, but also very practical, cynical even, maybe. We, you know, there are reasons for us to go. I'm arguing that's not what this is. If private business are going to do it, that's great. If the government can do it, that's great. If a government, if the world's governments can do it, that's great. I'm ambivalent about it. I'm agnostic about that. What I'm not agnostic about, what I do care about, is when that rhetoric is being deployed to make it seem like it's okay when people are taking that make it seem like people are taking risks that they're not. That is not the thing that these pilots are risking themselves for. It's for something else. And maybe that would be okay too. Maybe programmatically it would be okay with us to have this really complicated engineering project to be done in the service of something recreational for rich people. But that's not the decision that anybody's being allowed to make here. What we're being told is that it's worth risking pilots' lives because we're headed for the stars.
Okay. And what about some ancillary engineering discoveries that could make life a lot better for a lot of people, such as making travel a lot quicker? Maybe some discoveries through these voyages could lead to that kind of advancement for regular travel here on Earth.
Sure, you're talking about spin-off technologies, and it's a very powerful argument. The counter argument to it, and so spin-off technologies are tricky because historians of technology and futurists of technology, I suppose, can still argue today about whether there were viable spin-offs from Apollo. This is something that was 50 years ago now, right? But I think what you could also say is, well, could we spend the research dollars to just achieve those technologies rather than hope that they spin off of this much more complicated project? And I would say, like, I kind of don't want to get into that argument in some ways because that's not what's in front of us. What's in front of us is a company whose stated goal is to ask people to spend $250,000 to take a very short ride where they get to experience weightlessness on an experimental aircraft. That's what's in front of us. And that's what we have to be asking whether it's worth taking safety risks for, because I am suspicious of taking this company particularly as being an example of a first step into off the planet. There are other companies out there that are trying other technologies that look more like that to me, and I say that as somebody with some experience covering space programs, covering space science, covering private space, not as an expert, but as somebody who has been looking at this field, and that doesn't seem to me what this technology does. Now, if I'm wrong about that, and maybe we'll know that someday, then I'll have been wrong about this as well.
So some other men are also pioneering these efforts. Jeff Bezos, Paul Allen, Elon Musk, are they doing it better?
I mean, you know, that's my knee-jerk assessment is that they're doing it slower, and they're doing it different, and they're not asking for the same kind of publicity, if indeed any publicity at all. Jeff Bezos' program actively avoids this kind of publicity. I only know that because my friend Brad Stone, who's a great reporter, had to do real investigative work to figure out what was going on with Blue Origin. That's very different than this project. And you know, I mean, candidly, Richard Branson has a history of having companies that have more publicity than have more thunder than rain, let's say.
Mm. Right. And he has been criticized for that, for being very flashy, but also for advancing airline travel and for being at the forefront of other technologies. And in this particular instance, he does seem to be ahead of the competition. But is it possible that even after this accident, that in the long run, what he's doing with private space exploration, or not exploration as you put it, but private space travel, might be a good thing in the long run? Prices will come down and many of us will take one of these flights maybe in our lifetime.
I mean, maybe. Is that the goal here? I mean, are we trying to build a viable space tourism industry? I mean, we're trying
to build. It appears that many people are, yes.
Sure, but what they will say, again, this is the rhetoric about space tourism, is that space tourism is the first step, is the way that you fund a private space program because the government won't. That's the line, right, is that we want space tourism not just because it would be fun to go to space, but because we want to be able to leave the planet. We want to have permanent settlements on the moon and on Mars and somewhere else because we want to expand humanity into the stars.
And this might be one step toward doing that.
Well,
yes.
Right. And so the thing that I'm the flag that I'm trying to raise, the red flag I'm trying to raise here, is that this doesn't even seem like a technology that's designed to do that. This, as far except in its broadest sense, this is a technology that is designed to get you to the bottom of space, not into it and not through it. And if that's true, then what then what we're really describing here as a space tourism company is a company that's designed to get people excited about space, right? That's designed to get people willing to spend money on it and willing to accept the idea that people will go to space and willing to think that some other space program, some other company's program or government's program is a good thing worth funding. And then if that's true, and I know how harsh this sounds, but if that's true, what we're talking about is a PR campaign. Mm. And I'm actually fine with that too. That would be great. I actually think that that's worth doing. Except somebody's dead for that PR campaign, and that's why I think it's worth asking the question about what's worthwhile. So what's important to me is not to try to say is space tourism worth it, because I think space tourism's worth it. It's certainly not asking is space exploration worth it, because manifestly that's worth it, obviously. But I think what I want to ask is whether this company, whether what these people are doing is still worth it.
Adam Rogers, senior editor for Wired Magazine, thanks for joining us.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
All right, we want to know your thoughts. Is space tourism worth it? If you had $250,000, would you buy a ticket on Richard Branson's space flight program? Give us a call, 1-844-PRESS-PLAY, or join the conversation on Facebook, KCRW Press Play. Coming up, why TV networks cling to sweeps periods, even though TV watching has changed, and why prestige television is so white. That's next on Press Play.
Take KCRW with you on one of our smartphone apps. Available for the iPhone, Android, and BlackBerry, you can stream KCRW live, listen to podcasts, and all our news and music streams. Learn more and download at kcrw.com/apps.
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Fall sweep season has begun, and that used to mean that TV networks and local stations would pull out all the stops and use stunt programming to draw as many eyeballs as possible. These days, though, in an age of DVR, Netflix, HBO Go, does sweep season mean anything at all? Well, let's talk to two guys who have the answer to that question. Michael Schneider, executive editor for TV Guide magazine and co-host of KCRW's The Spinoff. Welcome back.
Hey, Madeline.
And Eric Deggans, TV critic for NPR. Welcome back, Eric.
Hey.
Okay, so Sweeps Week, that goes back, what, till the 1950s?
Kind of the dawn of television.
really? to
back when, everyone still, Nielsen still measured homes via diaries, and it took months sometimes to find out actually which demos were watching which programs. So thankfully, we've kind of moved past that. They've started measuring local markets, and now most of the top markets are measured every single day. So those diaries don't exist anymore, and you don't really need those sweeps anymore because...
And yet, here we are.
Old habits die hard, first off, and it's one of the banes of my existence. I don't understand why, especially here in L.A. and in New York, you still have these sweeps packages, the virus that's hidden in your school lunchbox
the local TV news.
Yeah, or they always take a black light to hotel sheets. Or, they're doing something crazy during November and May. They don't need to do that anymore, but yet they still have these sweeps packages because...
probably any way to gin up ratings is a good idea, and why not just hang it on a sweeps idea? Yeah.
Well, there's something else going on here, too, is that syndicated TV shows are still tied up in the sweeps system. They still use them, and they proportion their money for promotional ads around sweeps. So the local TV stations are still somewhat tied to the sweeps formula because they're getting advertising, they're getting money from the syndicated TV shows to pump up the sweeps months, which are still important to syndicated TV shows like the Queen Latifah talk show or the Steve Harvey show or Entertainment Tonight, shows that are sold individually throughout the country. And the TV industry is like this huge ocean liner that is really hard to turn. So even when you see the iceberg of sort of digital ways of counting audience coming at you, it is hard to turn that Titanic around and go to a new way of looking at ratings. So it's still handy to take a look at how ratings are playing out in November February and May.
The one benefit now that as sweeps doesn't matter as much in the major markets anymore is the networks don't do the kind of crazy things that they used to do even 10 years ago, where they would preempt all their regular programming and throw on all sorts of different specials and big events and things that they would all sort of put at the same time in November. Now they spread those things out throughout the year. They keep more of their original shows on in November. So we finally get a real snapshot in November of what how the networks are doing, as opposed to sort of this manufactured month of stunts and programs.
All right. So they have a good idea of what's working and what's not. And they're killing off the shows that aren't working. And last week we talked about Manhattan Love Story meeting the axe. And Eric, what is meeting a similar fate this week?
Well, I guess the big cancellation is Fox's Utopia. This was a show that they had planned to stretch out over a whole year, and they were going to have these people go to this undisclosed location and sort of build a new civilization from the ground up. And from the moment the show debuted, it tanked in the ratings. It got moved to Fridays, which is always a sign that a network is about to kill off a show. And then over the weekend, they canceled it. So it lasted about 2 months. And one of the things that's interesting to me is that I think reality TV on the networks is facing a crossroads. We've seen American Idol, we've seen The Voice, we've seen Biggest Loser, we've seen a lot of different iterations of The Bachelor, we've seen a lot of iterations of different kinds of unscripted television, and the new iterations are not working, and the old ones are getting old and losing audience. And I think unscripted television needs to be reinvented for network television, and unfortunately, Utopia was a big swing in that direction, and it failed miserably.
Well, I think the biggest problem with Utopia, Eric, is that some of these shows, they're just so hard to explain to audiences. And Utopia, there was sort of a complicated premise behind it. You know, they were trying to build a new world. Some people could come into the world, some people would leave. Part of it was, what is this show? And I don't think it was ever properly really articulated. And maybe they didn't know. It seemed like they were kind of changing things on the fly. So
it was this Frankenstein monster of different kinds of reality shows. It was a little bit of Big Brother and a little bit of Survivor and a little bit of this and a little of that, and it never formed a coherent whole. But the problem, again, I think, is that reality TV needs a new face for network television. Even The Voice is showing signs of its age, and these new reality shows, Rising Star on ABC and now Utopia, are not doing it. They're not catching the attention of audiences.
Well, let's talk about the other shows that were also canceled over the weekend. On NBC, two sitcoms, Bad Judge and A to Z, on Thursday night were canceled. They'll run out their remaining episodes, 13 episodes, but they won't be back after that. And that also goes to the other genre that's still in trouble, still in crisis at the networks, and that's comedy.
Rom-com.
There's one, rom-coms, but also comedy in general. Blackish is the one new comedy that's actually doing very well at the networks, but otherwise it's still tough to launch a comedy these days.
Okay, moving on to cable and scripted drama. HBO has a new show called Olive Kittredge. It's a miniseries, actually. It debuted last night. The critics seem to love it. It stars Frances McDormand as a hard-to-like character named Olive, and here's a clip of tape.
So how's school, son?
Fine. He's getting a C in English.
Oh.
Well, Casey does him grade fairly. I always do my work. I'm never late. He gives me a C.
Oh, that doesn't sound quite right.
It isn't, Dad.
Your son doesn't understand subtext.
Oh. Well, I don't really understand subtext either.
Oh, God, Henry.
Well, I mean, I think if Christopher is putting forth his best effort...
I read your son's paper. It is lazy, slapdash crap.
Oh, that's a little harsh, Ollie.
You don't know. You're not there. Jim O'Casey understands your son's abilities more than you do.
No.
He understands when they're being squandered. If you want your kid to grow up to be a dope, go ahead.
We're not finished yet.
Wow, this sounds like it's tough to watch, but compelling nonetheless. And she is not a lovable character. What did you think, Eric?
I really liked it. I have a story on NPR.org talking about this show and how it is this depiction of a marriage that lasts 25 years in which both participants go through this evolution where you could tell at one point they loved each other in that scene, and during that time they seemed to actively hate each other. They were irritated with each other in a million different ways. And then there's an acceptance that comes, you know, folks who've been married for a while know that marriages are not static. They evolve and they change over time as people change and circumstances impact them. And the book won a Pulitzer Prize by sort of telling the story over 12 stories. On HBO, we have four different stories, two that aired last night and two that air tonight. And it is a wonderful depiction of a long-running marriage between two people who are not quite what they seem when you first meet them.
Yeah, and I think it's interesting that Olive Kitteridge is on at the same time that The Affair is on Showtime, which is another show that's an investigation of a troubled marriage and relationships gone awry, and two fascinating looks at marriages and the sacrifices that you make, and sometimes the mistakes you make as well. So both great shows on virtually opposite each other this week, but both worth checking out.
As good as Olive Kitteridge is, it is every major character in the show is white. It's not very diverse. And one of the things that we're learning from the fall network shows is that diversity is clicking with audiences. Blackish, as Michael mentioned, is doing well in the ratings and is also did well with critics. Jane the Virgin, a show that's centered on a Latino cast, is doing well for the CW and also was well liked by the critics. There's a sense on network television that they finally figured out how to tell stories about people of color that resonate. But in the world of sort of quote-unquote prestige television, I'm not sure that we're there yet.
Yeah, that's really interesting because when you think about it, what show has there been that's been diverse besides The Wire in terms of that prestige cable programming?
Tremé on HBO.
And Tremé, yeah. And that's it.
Well, The Walking Dead, I don't know if you consider that prestige, but that is a show that's become increasingly more diverse. It got a lot of criticism early on for not being diverse, but when you watch it now, you see many characters of color who have major storylines and are fleshed out characters. So they're doing a good job there. I would like to see that sort of spread. Mad Men is one of these shows that's always bothered me that it's set during a time when America's racial attitudes were in flux and there was a lot going on and you almost never see it on the show. So perhaps the network TV can lead prestige cable a little bit in this instance.
That's so ironic given where this industry is at the moment. The one thing at least that broadcast network seems to be ahead of the curve compared to cable.
Yeah.
All right. Well, thanks, you guys.
Thank you.
Thanks, Madeline.
That's Eric Deggans, TV critic for NPR, and Michael Schneider, executive editor for TV Guide magazine and co-host of KCRW's The Spinoff. Coming up, a new UN report on global warming is pretty scary, but who's going to read it? That story next on Press Play after a news update with Eric Roy.
Listen to KCRW's 24-hour all-news channel. Stream BBC World Service, NPR, and KCRW programs. Continuous coverage and accessible via our smartphone app or online at kcrw.com.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. It's the starkest warning yet from the United Nations. A new report says if we do not significantly reduce greenhouse gas emissions, there will be irreversible changes to the Earth. There will be food shortages, refugee crises, flooding, mass extinction of plants and animals, and a dangerously altered climate. At the heart of the report is the idea that climate change is part of our present, not our future. And yet, there doesn't seem to be a sense of urgency about this in various governments or even among us, regular people. Are we tuning out these catastrophic reports or just not paying attention in the first place? Anthony Leiserwitz is the director of the Yale Project on Climate Change Communication, and he joins us now. Welcome.
Hi, Madeline. Great to be with you.
Well, nice to have you. Well, tell us about this report. It is the fourth and final report in a series, so it combines three earlier reports. And it really says that climate change is here, it's happening now, and we need to do something about it, right?
That's right. And it's the culmination of 5 years of intense work by more than 800 climate scientists and other climate experts around the world. As you said, there have been three prior reports in the past year that have been much more technical and really provide the foundation for this report that was just released, which is a very short summary. It's only 40 pages, so anyone can go and read this pretty easily themselves. That's really produced for policymakers. In fact, that's what it's called, a summary for policymakers. And it's really intended to help guide the international discussions about what can we do about climate change.
Well, I think a lot of us or a lot of the people in the positions of power know what they need to be doing. They're just not doing it.
That's true. I would say that actually the understanding of the problem itself, however, is not as well understood both in the United States and globally as one would hope. So, for instance, our global research, we've done work with the Gallup World Poll, finds that roughly 4 out of 10 people or adults on the planet have never heard of climate change before. So they don't really actually know about it. Now, that doesn't mean they're not seeing changes in their own local environments. They absolutely are, and they're actually very worried about them. But they don't yet have the concept of climate change to either make sense of what they're currently experiencing or much less what's going to happen over upcoming decades. And here in the United States, you know, most Americans have heard of global warming, but we know there's still a lot of confusion. I mean, only about half of Americans understand that it's mostly human caused. Only about 1 in 10 Americans actually understands that more than 97% of climate scientists, the people who study this, are fully convinced, based upon the evidence, that climate change is happening and human caused. Only 1 in 10 Americans understands that. So there's a lot of confusion still here in the United States as well.
Well, why is that? Because there is a lot of coverage of this. There's a lot of talk about it every time there's a heat wave. It seems that we're talking about climate change. These reports have come out, as you say. This is the fourth one. And so the reports have been out there and they have been covered. So why is it that there is this lack of understanding that you talk about?
Sure. Well, there's a lot of things going on. But first of all, actually, there's not that much coverage of it relative to all the other things that we talk about. So we've done media analyses, for example, and we find that climate change is, you know, in as of 2011, got about 0.1% of total news coverage across cable television, nightly network news, radio, magazines, newspapers. I mean, it's there, but it's tiny compared to the amount of press that, say, an issue like Ebola or ISIS and the beheadings are getting. So one is we just actually don't talk about it very much. Another critical factor, though, is, of course, there's a very strong and well-funded disinformation campaign, an effort by fossil fuel interests, who are some of the world's largest companies and richest companies, who are very happy with the status quo. Because ultimately, to deal with climate change is about accelerating the transition from fossil fuels, coal, oil, and natural gas, towards this new clean energy future of wind and solar and geothermal and so on and so on, that I think most people actually want. It's just about how quickly are we going to get there.
Well, the report says that we have to get to zero burning of fossil fuels by the end of the century to have a hope of keeping things in check. That would be no oil, coal, or gas.
That's correct. And that sounds like a lot. But on the other hand, you know, it's important to recognize that most of us don't have a love affair for coal, oil, or natural gas itself. I mean, you know, we don't put lumps of coal on our mantle at home and admire them. We really just want the service. I just want, when I flip the light, I want the lights to come on. When I turn the key in my car, I want the car to drive. I actually don't really care that much about whether it's powered by gas or electricity in terms of the performance of the utility or the car itself.
Right.
So I think that's what we're trying to do, is how can we make this transition to actually fueling our current lifestyle and hopefully improving lifestyle over the coming decades, just with a source that doesn't generate vast amounts of pollution.
But, you know, driving around, I'm seeing gas prices at $3 a gallon. They're dropping. Lots of SUVs on the road these days.
Mm-hmm.
Not much incentive to go for alternative energy when prices are so low.
That's true. And when prices go high, people tend to start buying more fuel-efficient vehicles. And so that's one of the reasons why most economists that study this say that one of the most important things we can do is to put a price on carbon. Right now, all the companies and countries and so on that are basically emitting this vast pollution into the atmosphere get to do so for free. They get to get all the economic benefit of burning the coal, oil, and natural gas and the energy it generates, but they don't have to pay any of the downstream costs of climate change, of impacts on human health, on impacts on poverty or farming or so on and so forth. Instead, society pays for all of those. And as a result, it's pretty expensive for society, but it's not expensive at all for those source users. So one of the primary policies that's proposed is to put a price on that pollution. And if you make companies and everyone incorporate that externality into their actual cost, that you'll begin to see people finding much more innovative ways to either be much more efficient with energy, as well as to make these, to accelerate the transition to these cleaner sources of energy.
Anthony Leiserwitz is the director of the Yale Project on Climate Change Communication. Thank you for joining us today.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Warren Olney is here. Happy Monday to you.
Well, the same to you. I don't want to throw cold water on your guest, but climate change is one of the least likely things to come out of tomorrow's election, as the Senate is taken over by the Republicans, or even if it's not. That's not one of the things that anybody thinks that they're going
to
come to terms with.
Not,
apparently not. We'll be talking about that and the election itself and what's likely to happen or not likely to happen. We may not know till next year whether the Republicans actually control the Senate.
Oh, my gosh. You're right, because there'll be runoffs.
Yeah, so if you're tired
Georgia,
of campaigning,
Georgia
and Louisiana, exactly. And it may take them a long time to get the votes in Alaska. I don't think they use sled dogs, but it's still it's hard to get them there where they need to go.
Because there's no snow left because of global warming. Warren Olney, thank you for joining us. That's at 1 o'clock in just 20 minutes from now, To the Point. And coming up on this show, Science for Her, a new satire from comedy writer Megan Amram. That's next on Press Play.
This podcast is produced by KCRW, a nonprofit public radio station based in Santa Monica. KCRW is listener-supported. Help us continue to create and distribute our unique content. Go to kcrw.com/join to donate. And thanks.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. What religion is best for your body type? What are winter's sexiest molecules? And please, won't someone figure out the most romantic places to see smog? Oh, someone has figured it out. In fact, she's written an entire book about this stuff. It's called Science for Her. And of course, it's a satire. It's set up like the unholy offspring of an issue of Cosmo and a middle school textbook. Comedian Megan Amram is the author of Science for Her, and she's here now with me in the studio. Welcome.
Hello, thank you. Welcome to your studio as well.
Well, thank you. There's a picture of you on the cover of Science for Her wearing a sexy lab coat, very busty looking.
Please, paint more of a picture. I want no one to see me in real life and just to hear you talk about me so eloquently.
Looking gorgeous and looking like the cover of Cosmo.
Yes, it was. That was my first big stipulation for the book, was it had to look exactly like a Cosmo. I want people to accidentally buy this book thinking it's a legitimate magazine or textbook and give it to their young children as gifts. So.
Not too young.
No,
it's not exactly G-rated.
It's definitely R-rated, but if a 10-year-old is reading this, I think I could really mold her mind to what I want it to be.
Okay, so this book is written from the perspective of your character,
yes,
Megan Amram.
This is a fake Megan Amram.
And you're doing it because you were jilted or by your boyfriend,
right,
who basically said you have no qualifications to be a scientist. And
yes, the Megan Amram who wrote this book is very obsessed with her ex-boyfriend, Xander, though she tries to play it off as just a fun fling or something she's gotten over. But Xander broke up with her at the beginning of the book because she somehow lied on her resume and was the head of the Northwest Division of NASA. And
so she's going to show him exactly what she knows about science.
Right.
And
so
she knows so much.
She knows so much, and she's willing to learn, and she's willing to teach all of her girlfriends, who are all her best friends, but she also kind of hates them and calls them fat a lot throughout the book.
And she hates trees because they're so tall and slender.
Yeah, they set totally unrealistic expectations for a woman's body. It's terrible to be a modern woman and to go outside and see these trees and know that you're never going to be that tall and brittle. It's horrifying. I barely can leave my house.
Well, maybe the brittle part if you live on the Upper East Side of Manhattan. I don't know.
Yeah, that's true. Enough tanning and there you go.
Enough tanning and no calcium.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see. The first chapter is a chapter about biology.
Yes,
right.
Which I understand is part of science. Through my research, I came to the conclusion biology is a part of science.
Tell us a little bit about what you've learned or what we will learn reading this chapter?
Biology is a very important chapter for the modern woman because a lot of it has to do with sex, please, and reproduction, which obviously is what you spend 99% of your time thinking about.
Of course.
The other 1% is fruit cups. That's all I'm thinking about is sex or a fruit cup. And I think that that's a good way to ease into science for women is to look at it in terms of your family and your children. So you'll learn about the scientific methods of birth control, which include the pill or wearing floor-length jean skirts so no one wants to have sex with you. And you'll learn some hot sex tips for releasing an ovum so that a man's sperm can fertilize it and you can have a child. Just a lot of fun stuff like that.
And then you'll learn maybe that if you get raped, you can't have a baby. You can't get pregnant.
Well, yeah. So that's actually a really exciting thing because I feel like I was nervous before I knew that. You know, it's scary every time you leave your house. You might run into someone in a back alley or a boyfriend or husband who decides to take advantage of you. But I looked into this. Todd Akin, a few years ago, a former representative, did say that the female body has ways to shut that whole thing down if you're raped, so you can't actually get pregnant in legitimate rape. And I looked into it, and he's totally right. He got a lot of flack for it, but scientifically, it's very grounded in reality. Your fallopian tubes tie up into a cute little bow if you're being legitimately raped so that no egg can get through. And these little barbs come out in your female genitalia, which I guess you could call teeth. It's all very interesting. And yeah, I'm excited to sort of prove his point.
Excellent. Well, let's hear his point.
It seems to me, first of all, from what I understand from doctors, that's really rare. If it's a legitimate rape, the female body has ways to try to shut that whole thing down.
I still can't get over that 2 years later.
I know. I can't get over how right he is. It's so crazy how much backlash he got. Also, come on, girls. We should be so proud of ourselves that our bodies just know how to deal with it.
So smart.
Yeah.
So we don't even have to think about it.
No. I mean, and I'm not thinking about it. Again, most of my day is spent thinking about fruit cups. So the fact that I don't have to think about whether it's a legit rape or not is good.
If you're just joining me, I'm speaking with Megan Amram. She has a new book. It's a satire book. It's called Science for Her! Now, in real life, Megan Amram, you went to Harvard. And Larry Summers ran Harvard for a little bit where he made these controversial statements about women and science.
Yes, which definitely that happened right before I was there. And that definitely was a talking point for a lot of people who were still there, which I guess to paraphrase was basically that maybe men are biologically more suited towards certain areas and maybe women are on average biologically suited towards other areas, meaning that maybe women do have a little deficit in science and math. And I disagree for a lot of reasons to transition into a sincere statement. But the first and primary one is that you never could tell what someone is more suited to be doing if there's an inequality in who is being funneled into those jobs. So women grow up thinking that they aren't adequate for science and math. And if you grow up thinking that way from the time you're a little kid, if you grow up thinking that you're a princess and you're not a scientist, then there's going to be a huge bias for how many women are going into jobs like that. So I think there is a movement now for young girls to be exposed to science and math and to be encouraged in those areas. And I think that's great because that's the only way we're going to actually see legitimate numbers is if men and women grow up equally thinking that they can do whatever they want.
And they could start by reading your book.
Yeah, I mean,
that is a science textbook for her.
Again, I think a six-year-old, you're going to have to explain some of the words in it, but...
And to enjoy pages upon pages of kale recipe ideas.
Yes, there's 300... There's a chapter called Kale that is just 300 names of recipes with kale in them, and then with four exclamation marks afterwards. I did read that for my audiobook, and it's about 20 minutes long of just me... screaming kale recipes. So that was very, very exciting.
So did you have to do a lot of research into these women's magazines to kind
of
get the right tone? And
yes, I did. I when I first started writing the book, bought probably 20 women's magazines all in a stack, and then a bunch of textbooks. And I hoped that it was the first time anyone has made that exact purchase at Barnes & Noble. But I read all these magazines all at once because I wanted to get into a little bit of a hypnotic state so that I was so deep in the voice of the magazines, I would be able to emulate it. And it really is crazy to read all of those all at once. The different things that they talk about rotate so frequently and come back. There's not that many things in a magazine like Glamour or Cosmo. It's hot trends that you should buy for that season. It's how to make yourself look nice to go out on a date. It's why isn't my relationship working? But the editorial voice in almost all the magazines is this one that's very casual and is talking to you like you're her best girlfriend and that she can like share little secrets with you, but also that she's nagging you and making fun of you a little bit.
Telling you maybe you could lose a few.
Yeah, because inherently, if you're trying to tell someone why they don't have a boyfriend, you're saying it's because of something they're doing.
Right.
And that passive aggressiveness made me laugh so much, and I really hit it home in the book where the dedication page is literally 20 pages long, and it's dedicated to all my best friends. And then it's just a list for pages and pages of girlfriends. But then I constantly make fun of them for being fat, that their hands are too fat to turn the pages or whatever I say.
Now, you also are a writer for Parks and Rec.
I am, yes.
And so that has a very strong female lead character,
yeah,
and other strong female characters. And so what is it like in the writer's room?
It is really wonderful. We have created a space which starts with my boss, who is a man who considers himself a very strong feminist, and Amy Poehler, who obviously is an awesome crusader. And we talk about a lot of these issues all the time in a very, I think, nuanced and intelligent way. There's a lot of women writers, too. And working at Parks and Rec for the past few years has definitely heightened how much I think about women in the media.
How so?
I think that working for a show with such a nuanced female character, so she's not just an archetype, she's not a harpy or just a hot girl, or there's a handful of characters that women play all the time. Amy Poehler's character, Leslie, is so many different things. She's super professionally successful, but she's also quote-unquote girly. She loves baking and crafts, and she blends all these things that is representative to me about what's exciting to be a woman now, which is that you can like whatever you want to like. So I grew up loving math and science, and I also have loved Hello Kitty and nail art for a long time, and I am very proud that I get to do both those things, and they're totally legitimate. So I think thinking about writing female characters like Leslie, who are very nuanced like a human being is, has been a real treat and something that I would like to do forever, I think, unless I get really sick of women. We do suck, and so I might just get sick of writing those characters and just write men again. But for now, it's really cool.
Ever think, I'm not going to do this anymore, I'm really going to go into science for real?
Yes, for real, I honestly have. I think that there's this split part of me where one half loves writing and loves comedy and entertainment, and everything having to do with that. And then there's the other half, which my whole life has been very analytical and interested in medicine. My whole family is full of doctors. I'm very squeamish, so I never was going to become one. But that's the great thing about being a writer is I feel like if I go back and get an astrophysics degree, that somehow I can probably keep using it in my writing.
Space for her.
Perfect. Oh, my God. You're so smart. I never would have thought of that.
Thank you. Although maybe I could lose a few. I don't know.
You're on the radio. You sound totally normal and beautiful, so I wasn't going to say it. But once we go off the air, I'm going to give you some tips.
Megan Amram, her new book is called Science for Her. Megan, thank you for coming in.
Thank you so much.
Feedback for you.
For everybody, Madeline.
Yes.
This is a segment for all to enjoy the bounty of feedback. We led the show today with a conversation about space tourism. This after the Virgin Galactic space plane crashed in the Mojave on Friday. Mm-hmm. And we wanted to know what you all thought about space tourism. Is it worth the risk? David Donnell weighed in on Facebook. It was like a 4-paragraph long, really, really good reply. There was like a lot of bravos. I was going to say something, but David covered it. Anyway, he says that we've wasted decades waiting for the government to lead us to the next generation of space exploration. And now that we've seen private companies move in where NASA has left off, we're actually seeing some new technologies that are needed for this next wave of space exploration. As a species, as humans, we need to decide not to listen to those who are frightened by the unavoidable failures that come from pushing boundaries. Thomas Bunce agreed with David. He was one of the yay Davids, but he wanted to add one thing. He says, 40,000 people die every year in auto accidents for the adventure of driving to work. Just to put the death of the test pilot in context. Tragic for sure, but it does need some context. But George Caballo says that if rich people want to spend $250,000 to strap into a large winged bomb, more power to them. I'm guessing that George is not in the camp that would, if he had $250,000 laying around, I'm not sure that he would be on a space flight. And Richard wonders if the CEOs of these space tourism companies would go on any of these test flights, you know, because it's for the greater good.
Well, Richard Branson did say he wanted to be the first on the first commercial flight. So we'll see.
We shall see.
Okay. Julie Myers, thank you very much.
Of course.
And keep the feedback coming. We love to hear from you. Facebook, KCRW Press Play. And our Twitter is at KCRW Press Play. Warren Olney, To the Point, up next at 1 o'clock. I'm Madeline Brand. Thanks so much for listening. Have a great day. I'll see you tomorrow.